Hey there, and welcome to Speakeasy with Kendra Fisher. Join me each week as my guests and I take a deep dive into all of the conversations we've been taught are better left unsaid. No more silence, no more hiding. This is a safe space where anything goes. This week, I'm speaking with Dr. Matthew Leonardi, endometriosis specialist and my surgeon. Good day, everybody. And I'm so excited today. It's not every day you get an opportunity to sit with your surgeon anywhere other than the operating room. But today is my lucky day. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Leonardi.
Thank you for having me, Kendra. It's been great to know you in a more personal setting as your physician, as your surgeon, and getting to know you now more professionally as well and the great work you're doing. I'm happy to be part of that professional endeavor to teach and to share.
I appreciate it. So, I mean, a little bit of a funny story just to kind of segue here. So, Dr. Leonardi is my surgeon. I live with endometriosis and I was referred to his clinic. And unfortunately, through no fault of his, the number of people in the world who have Dr. Leonardi's expertise are not as great as the need. And so there was a little bit of a time period of waiting to meet Dr. Leonardi. And I remember the first day that I met him, it was actually on Valentine's Day. So I thought it was only appropriate that I showed up with some roses for him just to start our relationship off on the right foot. So I thought that was fun. I just want to know a little bit quickly, how did you get into this? I mean, it feels like a really specific vocation. And I'm really curious a little bit your journey to getting into becoming one of the top endometriosis doctors in the world.
Well, it was to get roses, obviously.
You know, for sure. That's fair. Noted.
Everybody has to bring roses. No,
we're going to make this the new standard.
Yeah, please do not bombard me with roses. I mean, the gesture was very kind, and anytime anybody wants to show gratitude, obviously it's well received, because you know I know how hard it is, not personally, but through my profession, through my journey, how hard it is to be a person with endometriosis, and how much you struggle with the disease, but also with everything else that comes alongside it, navigating the healthcare system, having people believe you, whether that's a physician or an employer or a partner or, you know, anybody in your life. It's an invisible disease. It's really, really tough. And so when I have this perspective now, it's sort of these elements of the disease and the experience with the disease that ultimately led me to focusing on it. There's so much that needs to be done because there's so poor standards of care across the world for it right now. And without people who are going to make big strides and try to change how things are done, nothing is going to change. People will continue to suffer. And I can tell you even more nitty gritty if you want, like, you know, the history of how I got there, but that was the fundamental sort of philosophy behind how I fell into this space.
I'll be honest. I am very interested and I do want to ask you to go into it, but at the same time, there's so much to cover here and I don't have you infinitely here. So as I please don't take it as me not being curious of your journey to this, because I very much am, but
yeah,
I think there's so much valuable information for you to share.
Yeah, I agree. And if people want to know more of the history, then check out some of the other podcast interviews I've done, you know, where I tell the story of how this all happened. And if you're, you know, a healthcare provider potentially listening to this and you're thinking, how can I do that? Then maybe those other podcast stories will give you some path.
And I'll take a look. I'll see if I can't find some of those links and share them with people so that we can draw light to that. Now, you alluded to endometriosis being an incredibly difficult illness to live with. And I mean, I can attest to that personally. But I mean, can you give a little more insight to those who don't know? Because quite frankly, for me to share it, it feels like something I've been whining about for years now. And that's often how I feel. I feel like it's like, everybody's just like, oh, Kendra's hurting again. Or, you know, she's, you know, or not. Or like, oh, she's just saying this, or she's, you know. So can you give people a little bit more insight as to how much it affects people and why that is.
Well, let's start at the beginning. It essentially arises in most people in their adolescence at a time where you're figuring out who you are, how you fit into the world. You're learning about your body through puberty, and it's all in an incredibly weird and complex time. And then on top of that, you start to experience pain. And often alongside that, people normalize it. People tell you it's normal for women to have pain. It's normal for your periods to be painful. It's normal. It's normal. It's normal. And you're thinking, well, I'm suffering. So what kind of a normal life is this going to be? This is a terrible life. So it starts at the beginning. And for most people, it's actually not really well acknowledged or treated for way too many years.
Yeah.
There is better awareness now, and there's opportunities to start initiating treatments earlier now. But broadly speaking, I think we're still in a bad place from that perspective. And it's a chronic disease. So it doesn't go away. And even postmenopausally, when hormones in the body kind of go back to their pre-pubertal state of low estrogen, low progesterone, it doesn't really ever go away. So it's this thing that exists with you forever. We don't have a cure for it. We don't have all really that great treatments. There are some that are newer, that are maybe optimistic, and the multimodal approach is really optimistic, but there's no cure. There's no great treatments. So you got to figure out, how do I live my life to its fullest with this terrible disease? And how do I do that in the context of my family, my job, my hobbies? Everything that you aspire to is so difficult. And because of the early onset of that normalization and invalidation, a lot of people like you, Kendra, have had this kind of persistent presence of invalidation leading to own doubts within.
Yeah.
Is my pain real? Am I weak? Am I a nuisance to people? Am I a burden to people? And none of that yet is really being all that well addressed by our health system or in society, because we're not even good at treating the physical part of it, let alone all of the psychological and social sequelae of the disease as well.
And so, it's so hard to not get emotional just listening to you talk about it, because it is. It's so all-encompassing all the time. And it's hard to get past that piece of women's health that is like, okay, well, whatever, she's got her period and she's got cramps. Too bad. What's the level of difference? Because I know my experience, and I mean, I don't think people understand how serious and how involved endometriosis can be. I mean, it's not a matter of I had bad cramps or I had, you know, heavy menstruation. It was like I was in pain 3 weeks of the month. I was menstruating 2.5 weeks of the month. Like, you know, it's not just that. And like, are we getting better at the information out there as to how involved it can be? And again, that limiting belief system of like endometriosis just means you have heavy periods and you cramp more.
Mm-hmm. So I think people should understand that there is always going to be some degree of a cramp or discomfort with the event of menstruation or uterine bleeding.
Yeah.
Because the uterus is a muscle that has to contract to push out content.
Yeah.
And that's expected. That's normal. People should still be able to function sometimes without any types of medication, or if you were to need, for example, an ibuprofen, and then your inflammation and your pain settles and you go about your day. This is what we would consider to be within normal limits of a period or a uterine bleed event that is okay. But when you are not getting good control of your pain through use of typical anti-inflammatories, you have to miss school, you have to miss work, you have to cancel social plans. This is when things start to get into there are flags here. This is not okay. And people should not have this event cause havoc in their life or limit their life potential. And endo traditionally starts off as cyclical period-related pain. But what ends up happening is due to the chronic exposure to inflammation, the process of sensitization occurs, this is when the nearby structures of the bowel, the bladder, the muscles become sensitized to other experiences and start to feel those other experiences as painful, even when those experiences are physiologically normal. Kind of a classic example is a full bladder can be felt by the pain system as painful. No, a full bladder is not something that our brain should interpret as pain. Obviously, yeah. We need to know when our bladder is full because, you know, you need to empty it and you can't explode your bladder. But you don't want to feel that as pain. The other examples are ovulation, normal physiologic process. And yes, there is potentially some degree of pain that can come along with that, because literally it is the rupture of a fluid-filled sac into the pelvis. And that can be kind of insulting to the coverings, the peritoneum. But some people cannot function when that happens. Not normal. Bowel movements, sex, these things that are physiologically normal events should not become painful, and they do. And then people end up with a baseline pain every day, all the time, or kind of roller coaster like episodic type pains because of that constant exposure to inflammation leading to sensitization. It can really take over people's lives.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple things you mentioned there that I want to go back to. One of those things being that multimodal approach, and something that I think we fail miserably in all areas of the healthcare system, because I don't think that we can treat body and mind as separate entities. I think that we need to recognize, and I mean, I'll be honest with you, I'm actually currently training to become like a neuroscience coach, just because I want to understand this, what I've been through, and I'm trying to go through this process that we're about to talk about. So in terms of the multimodal approach, everybody thinks endometriosis, first thing that comes to mind is birth control, the pill, we're going to try to control the period and hopefully that will alleviate symptoms. That doesn't work. You get into some of the stronger medications with a little bit more impact on day-to-day life, possibly, possibly not. Hopefully it works. And then everybody knows, okay, hysterectomy, or let's remove it if we can. You know, excision surgery is the gold standard. But gratefully, your team has started to go beyond that. And I wanted to discuss some of those things because I think it's so important in overall support for the illness in a different way and why that's so important. So can you tell us a little bit about Endo 360?
Absolutely. But before I tell you about Endometriosis 360, I got to come back to some of the terminology here around excision surgery being the gold standard.
Please do. Please do.
Okay. So, you know, I exist very, very presently on the socials, and I understand the reason why endometriosis is very popular in the social media space. People have to take charge of their own lives and teach themselves and be a supportive community. Lots of amazing things yes. are happening there, but there are certain perpetuating statements that are actually not that helpful. So surgery for endometriosis is one of the treatment options, and it should be, in my opinion, when used in combination with other treatment options in this multimodal approach, which we'll talk about.
Yes.
But it's gold standard is a terminology that's actually used more in the context of a diagnostic test. So there's like a gold standard diagnostic test, which is the test that has the best diagnostic accuracy overall. Okay. Not so much in the context of a treatment.
Okay.
The reason I'm sort of anti this statement is it puts a lot of pressure on people to go into the office and say, I need this best treatment, the gold treatment, the gold standard exactly. treatment. Right. And I don't know, maybe, you know, you like the term because of your sports history and gold.
It medals. Might be. It might be. I'm here to be reprogrammed, so I'm good with it.
We aspire to gold, right? So people go in and they say, I need this gold standard treatment. And then they feel that somebody doesn't think it's the right treatment for them, that they're actually gatekeeping. And I stand, you know, by my advice to patients, which is individualized, and not everybody is going to do well from a surgery.
Yeah.
So they then might feel a discrepancy, actually, between I'm hearing this, it's the gold standard, but Leonardi or so-and-so is not offering it and actually telling me that I shouldn't have it.
Yeah.
And I think me and my team are pretty good at explaining the why.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure everybody else is as good. I mean, some people may be better than me at certain explanations, but mm-hmm. broadly speaking, generalist OBGYNs who say, you know, you can't have surgery for endometriosis, it's not a good thing, is discrepant to what people are hearing online, and they're not getting into the really nitty-gritty nuanced explanation behind it.
And so, I actually just further to that, I really appreciate the breakdown because there is a lot online. I remember when I was first diagnosed, everybody was like, go join these endo support groups, go do this, go do that. And a lot of the conversation is around, they are just telling me it's nothing, or I feel gaslit, or they don't believe I'm hurting. And I think that the whole perpetual stereotype lives in that misinformation kind of going in circles. And unfortunately, and I find this a lot in the work I do in mental health, is a lot of people don't recognize that you also have to participate. So yes, you can go in and you can get treatment and you can have the guidance and support of a surgeon or a doctor, but you also have to learn and participate in the other multimodal facets that exist without then just kind of shunning those and waiting for somebody else to make it all better for you. Because unfortunately, there's a lot more to it.
Absolutely. And I feel really sad for people because I want there to be an easy fix, quick solution. I wish that surgery was the panacea. We do it and everybody is better. But that's not the case. And mm-hmm. we know that. And people online in the social media groups or those outside probably also know that, because if it was, then why are people still suffering? Why yeah. are people not getting better yeah. from their endometriosis symptoms despite having surgery by the best surgeons?
Yeah.
And then you start to get into these somewhat damaging dialogues of, oh, it just wasn't the right surgeon, or they might have missed it, and then I yeah. need a repeat surgery.
Yeah.
And then you start to actually do harm, because surgery is a pain-generating event. It is a very disruptive event. It creates inflammation. It has risks. And even if there are no major complications like bleeding, transfusion, damage to an organ, it is still a pain-generating event. And so if what people are learning is, oh, I didn't have the gold standard surgical excision by the right surgeon,
yeah,
then they're going to go back again, and they're not going to commit to the right things that need to happen for them through that multimodal approach.
Yeah.
So I really think that the surgeons out there that are focusing mostly on excision surgery need to adopt a multimodal approach, need to bring in a team. We don't do it all ourselves, obviously. Like, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a physiotherapist. You've got to build a team for our patients. You cannot just do surgery. And if you're on the side of the patients listening to this, it's not just finding the right surgeon. I mean, that is part of the agenda, because there is a spectrum of skill and expertise.
Yeah.
But you just, if you're still unwell after a good surgery by a good surgeon, probably it's not that surgery is the solution in this case.
Yep.
It's yep. that surgery may be part of the solution and there's other pieces missing.
Which is where I'm at. I mean, I'm proof of this. I mean, I'm somebody who went through the pain, went through the waiting period, got to a point where it forced me out of work. It forced me to a place where that pain was significant. And I also understand all of the facets that go into that. I tried birth control. It didn't work for me. That was my experience with it. The medications that could have helped weren't effective for me. I recognize lots of people have great results with that, and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. We ended up in a place of surgery, and we did the excision surgery. I blew myself away, and I actually waited to do all of the physicality after, and I did the recovery period. And I came at it with that approach of like, okay, I'm better now. Like, I can go at this now. And I started in hard. I gave myself a really quick lesson in, hey, you've just gone through this huge thing, and maybe you can't go run 8K right now. And maybe you can't just go out to the gym and lift the way you did. You're going to have to actually approach this differently. And that's when I started to learn, and we kind of revisited, and you were telling me more about the multimodal approach and why it's so important because of how my body now interprets pain. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about that, because this is a program that I'm now signed up for. This is, you know, I'm very lucky to be supported by the team that you've enlisted for this. And I'm so hopeful that putting in that extra effort is going to support a better recovery for me.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, everybody I operate on, well, not everybody, but most people are better, but nobody is perfect. Nobody is saying, you know, you have completely 100% cured my pain and all my gynecologic and pelvic problems.
Oh, it's night and day difference. Don't get me wrong. Just let me insert that right there. It is night and day difference.
But... And that's a really important thing to kind of recognize, because what we aim to do, me, my team, and Endometriosis 360 is now part of this, is we aim to get people better and better and better. You know, again, we don't aim for zero pain. We don't aim for perfection, but we aim to find methods to improve people. And surgeries can be a very big part of that journey. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, when we do a concurrent hysterectomy for a patient with endometriosis excision surgery, people tend to do a lot better as well, because you actually do take away an independent pain-generating event, which is the actual menstruation, the actual uterine contraction, which happens exactly simultaneously with inflammation from endometriosis. So there are sort of two streams. So people who just have excision of endometriosis and leave their uterus, generally speaking, don't do as well as those who have a concurrent hysterectomy. Mm-hmm. But after surgery, before surgery, is when we really should be integrating the multimodal approach. So I will sort of try and describe this as simply as possible. There are three categories of treatment that we talk about in medicine. One is medications. This could be a hormonal medication, a hormone modulating medication. It could be a medication that focuses on the nervous system, like a neuropathic pain medication, for example, anti-inflammatory. So there's medications. Then there's surgery. And within the surgery box, there's quite a few different types of surgeries. And I just explained some people have excision of endometriosis with hysterectomy, some without. And then sometimes we also do other concurrent things like bowel surgery for those with bowel endo, or take out the appendix. And so there's quite a number of subheadings under surgery. And then the complementary and alternative management box is where currently everything else falls. And this is, in my opinion, probably the most important box for the endometriosis patient. There are several subheadings within this. The main ones that we focus on at the moment, partly due to evidence supporting and partly due to availability of individuals in these spaces, are pain psychology, pelvic floor physiotherapy, and a registered dietitian approach. I call these people, the ones that I work closely with, pelvic health dietitians, the individuals in each of these spaces who are essentially aware of gynecology and of the gynecologic function in association with their own individual spaces. So physio understands how the uterus and the ovaries work and how endo exists and what endo does and how that has an interplay with the muscle system and the bone system and the functionality of the pelvis. The psychologist understands the interplay between the psychology system, how our mind exists, how our mental health exists in association with gynecology and endometriosis. So each of these people are really aware of the interplay. And through Endometriosis 360, I've combined a pain psychologist, Dr. Laura Katz, a pelvic floor physiotherapist, Jill Mueller, and a registered dietitian, Emily Optoff, in an interdisciplinary program involving an initial assessment, 90 minutes, all in, all of them together with you, the patient, and very immersive, very information gathering and information giving. And for those eligible, as determined by the allied healthcare professional team, we've instituted a group program, which will be first launched next year, early next year. We'll do our first group involving 6 sessions, 2 hours apiece over 6 weeks. And the main premise to this is really helping people understand what their body is doing, when is it doing it, why is it doing it, and how to regain control through understanding the mechanisms, the physiology and the pathophysiology of the organs and the systems involved.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is where my current interest is, obviously, because this is one where I am on this journey. But also I think, and kudos to you, and I want to say that I appreciate so much. So a surgeon, a medical doctor, standing there and saying, I think one of the most important pieces of this journey is that holistic and encompassing multimodality approach. Because oftentimes I think people feel as though those are lesser supports and lesser practices. And when you sit there and people, I know I went through it myself. I'm going through and you take the best information and you try to apply it. You know, at one point somebody said red meat causes inflammation, so I stopped eating red meat. And as somebody else suggests, you know, perhaps this will work. And at that point, you're desperate. At that point, you're willing to try anything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But there is a lot of science behind inflammation in the body and how it affects illnesses like endometriosis. And so to have a doctor validate that, I think, is so important. And the fact that you're actually putting together an entire program around the idea is incredible, because I think, again, those social groups online and all of those conversations around it, you get a lot of naysayers who will step on and be like, okay, fine, like they told me to go to pelvic physio, or okay, fine, they told me to, you know, talk to a psychologist, and immediately that feels like they're being discarded. So when you have an actual specialist in the space standing up with his medical license and saying, no, this is valid. Like I can help you. I can be this piece. We can have this piece, but there's all these other pieces that you need to bring in. And consistently, as you need to with any chronic illness, it's not you sit with the results of surgery and expect your life to just be clear sailing from then on. And that's the space that I'm really interested in, because I find the overlap in that, obviously, with my own mental health journey and the work I do in the mental health space. Again, a chronic illness that nobody else can see, that can be absolutely life-altering in a very debilitating way. And people want the answer to be handed to them. They want the cure to be fixed for them. And I want to share in the narrative of, you have to participate. You can't just expect that a chronic condition is made not chronic by one action, because that's just, it's not how it works.
It's not how it works. No. When I was a resident in Toronto, there was not really a whole lot of dialogue around the utility of the allied healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
Physio dialogue was starting to arise a little bit, not so much with endo patients, but for things like vulvodynia. I learned a little bit about it then. And it took me on my own independent journey to realize the inadequacies of our traditional health system, to understand where the gaps are and what needs to be integrated. And simultaneously, and even before I entered the space, people have been talking about diet and physio and psychology. Like, it's not new. It's just, it's not really been done in a standardized fashion. It's not mm-hmm. been done in an easy fashion. Even when I started, I would tell people, okay, so you need to get a physio, you need to get a dietitian, you need to get a psychologist. And never did I aim to do that in a way that was invalidating or making people believe they're making it up, but, you know, trying to instruct them on that approach. But you know how hard it is to do that in our health system? Yeah. And how expensive it is to do that in our health system?
Yeah.
And to find the people who are actually knowledgeable and giving people the right advice. Like, the number of people who've come back to me and said, oh, I did physio and they made me do Kegels. I'm like, oh, this is the exact opposite
of what you want to do. Therapy
you need to do for pelvic pain. This will make you worse, or at least not in isolation. You know, strengthening is important, but if that's the main instruction they've given you, then this is clearly a physiotherapist whose expertise probably lies in incontinence or in prolapse, not in pain.
No, it's like telling somebody to deadlift when their back's out.
It's you need to know what you're advising people on, and sometimes people don't know what they don't know. Actually, that's a lot of the cases around endometriosis, full stop. So Endometriosis 360 is something we've curated in a way that brings together people who have expertise and are already endo-aware. You don't have to convince them your pain is real. You don't have to convince them that endometriosis is a valid condition that deserves treatment. It's something that you go in and they already know. They already believe you. It's there. And then the instructions, the validation, the the journey mm-hmm. of the multimodal approach can really begin if it's not already. I'm really excited for it.
So am I. I've done my, again, like I said, I dove in when I was given the opportunity because I'm somebody who I guess understands a little bit more in depth in terms of the necessity for it all, given my past experiences. So I did the intake and I spoke with all three of the professionals that you mentioned. And I mean, again, it's that whole, it never ceases to amaze me when people understand how quickly it just opens you up to feeling a different experience. And I mean, I sat there and, you know, they start asking questions about things like, you know, trauma or, and you're sitting there and you're thinking about it. And it's like, you just know immediately that there's a level of understanding that you've never been faced with before. And the weight of it immediately changes. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the psychology aspect because I'm in mental health, so I like talking about psychology. But two, because I think there's a really important piece here that I often see online that I would like to hear your take on. And having heard you speak about this before, I think I kind of already... I just think it needs to be shared as often as possible. And that's around pain experience. You get a lot of people who, in living with endometriosis, have had that experience over and over and over again that you're being dramatic. It's not there. You're not hurting that much anymore. This doesn't make sense. It's gone. There's nothing there to have hurt anymore. Like just, you name it, there's an experience that has been negative in relation to pain. And I think that people think they're not being believed when the answer is you need to consider talking to somebody. You need to, because automatically then you bring in, you invite that stigma of mental health in, which is, how is a psychologist going to affect my pain? How is a psychologist going to have any impact on the fact that I am buckled over here and I can't get off my couch? And I think that there's a huge disconnect in understanding the psychology of pain and how pain works in the body and why our bodies can still interpret things in a way that does, in fact, create that level of pain. But perhaps the answer to managing it or mitigating a different experience has nothing to do now with a physical action.
Mm-hmm. This space is incredibly fascinating and complex. So let me try and break this down a little bit in a way that hopefully will be easier to understand. Pain is always real. This is principle number one. Pain is not something that you are making up. It's not in your head. It's not fake. It's always real. We have a pain system in our body. It's part of our nervous system. And that pain system is trained to recognize signals. And when those signals are heard, pain is experienced. Signals can be endometriosis inflammation, or signals can be, like we were talking about earlier, a full bladder. The pain system can interpret events in the body as pain, even when there's not actual danger there, because that's how the pain system trains. It's like how you can train for a marathon or you can train to learn a language. Your body has the ability to become good at something. And even though the pain system is supposed to be good at recognizing pain, it can be trained incorrectly to recognize things that are not pain. So endometriosis, when inflamed at the time of a menstruation, most classically, sends signals and the brain realizes that. With time, the constant exposure makes that pain system become dysfunctional and you get pain all the time, even when there's not danger happening. That is really key. Endometriosis is bad. It's very serious, but it's not always dangerous. And so when it comes to the psychology of managing pain, we need to first understand why the pain is happening and is there danger. And this is where I come in and talk a lot about diagnosis as therapy, is the understanding of what is happening in my body now. Is something dangerous happening or is something not dangerous happening? And when you figure out that something not dangerous is happening, we have to say to our pain system, I hear you, you are there, you are real, you are valid, but you are not creating harm in my body right now. So you have to talk back at it and you have to learn how to do that. And you have to tell it, leave me alone in this moment. And I know that for people who are really struggling, probably at the infancy of their pain journey, this sounds absolutely crazy that you can tell your pain system that you are okay, but it's not crazy. And this is not just in the space of endometriosis and persistent pelvic pain. This is in all pain spaces. People who have had motor vehicle collisions, people who have had amputations, people who have had any type of problem, they have to retrain their pain system to know when they're safe and when they're not safe. I actually use the imaging to tell me this. So ultrasound can diagnose endometriosis in a lot of people. We can't rule it out when the scan is normal, but what we can rule out is danger. We can say to people, your uterus, your ovaries, your bowel, your bladder, your ligaments, your anatomy is overall in a very, very safe place. Nothing acutely dangerous is happening. And even though endometriosis may be there in its smallest form called superficial endometriosis, this is not imminently dangerous to you. It's real, it's valid, it's painful, but it's not dangerous. So we have to change the relationship with it. And this is really where the psychologist comes into play. I hope that was kind of clear.
Absolutely. Okay. And again, I think so important because I think so many people equate certain things with being invalidated. And when you are living consumed with physical pain and emotional pain, and that becomes cyclical because one exists with the other. Nobody feels great emotionally when they're in physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Nobody who is on cloud nine emotionally is buckled over in pain at that moment. The two don't coexist. So our ability to, and I think the key word that you used and one that I stress is train. It is something that can be retrained. It is something that the hope exists to be able to change that experience if you work at it. You don't just have to accept I'm going to be in pain for the rest of my life. I've done all of the things. I've checked my boxes. There's been surgery. There's been medication. This is what I'm left with. And I think that that's so important.
It's so important that it should not only be implemented in that post-operative part of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
We're now diagnosing young girls with endometriosis, 12, 13, 14. And this is a good thing because historically these people would have gone 5-10 years without knowing what's happening in their body.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have to start implementing concepts of pain safety, pain neuroscience at this young age. We have to really amplify the validity of pain is real. And we have to simultaneously teach people when they need to be worried and when they don't need to be worried. Mm-hmm. Because we can actually prevent the mistraining of the pain system by starting to regulate things at a much, much earlier age. And in some ways, I can envision this being harder because it's kind of like if you're a young person and you eat whatever you want and you don't exercise, you don't really notice things like weight gain per se, you don't have detrimental impacts because you kind of get away with a lot of stuff being young and healthy. But then, as you age, you got to stretch before you exercise. You're going to injure yourself. You got to eat healthy or the weight just kind of like comes on.
I feel attacked.
You age, what's that?
I feel attacked.
We're pretty much the same age group. So, our bodies are going through similar things. Not endo in my case, but, other similarities. So I think where people are in their state of mind from a change management standpoint is going to be very different if this is a new problem for you. And you're angry about it because, it's really bad that you have endo and you have every right to be angry. but you haven't lived with it for 10 years where then you're like, I know I have to live with it. And now I have to figure out how to live with it. Mm-hmm. So understanding how we can preemptively help people understand the science behind how you prevent your pain system from becoming dysfunctional.
Yeah.
This will be a really interesting and challenging space for us, but we have to, because we don't want everybody that has endo to end up with daily pain.
Yeah. And I can totally attest to that. I mean, I, you say that, and I'm just sitting here thinking, my goodness, I wish I had that preemptively when I was a child, because my anxieties, it stems primarily from health. And so I'm one of those people where my anxiety growing up was often that panic of, why am I feeling this? Why is this? Why am I in pain? Nobody's giving me answers. Something's not okay. I'm not safe. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we don't do well at prevention ever, because we don't do well until there's a desperation included in our necessity. Desperation creates necessity. And when you are in a place where it is, I can still get through life with this, I can still do this, you set it aside until all of a sudden you can't anymore. And I'm guilty of it. I'm guilty of it.
We're all guilty of that in so many domains of our life. You know, we push things as far as they can before you can't. And then it's like, now I got to make time for this, right? Like in my calendar, I have exercise, because if I don't, you know, really make it a priority, you know, I'm going to end up with diabetes in 15 years. So, you know, you got to start to think a little bit more proactively about it. And maybe what will happen, and I'm sure that if Jill, Laura, and Emily listen to this, they're probably going to be very excited. But you know, we need to have like a 12, 13, 14-year-old endometriosis 360 group.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if we don't have a diagnosis per se, but we have a suspicion, then at least implementing the education around how the pelvic organs work, why they do what they do, how pain is real but not always dangerous, these pain science principles.
Yeah.
We need an adolescent group, because we can actually prevent this from becoming catastrophic.
Yeah. And how we manage it and how we respond to it, and inadvertently then how it ends up affecting our entire existence. Because I'm, again, like I said, when this was mentioned to me, this opportunity to be in the endometriosis 360, I'm giddy about it, because it impacts so many parts of my life, and I know it all to be true, but that doesn't mean that I can just turn it on. And that's the problem. You don't learn to swim when you're drowning. You don't get tossed into the deep end when you don't know how to swim and figure out how to get out of it without a scratch. Like you end up then having to fight for your life. And that's what endometriosis has felt like. It has felt like, in so many aspects of my life, the fact that it's I've been on leave from work for 2 years. I can't actively and successfully in a healthy way be a firefighter when I am constantly managing pain and emotional distress and pain management and relationships. It has a huge effect on relationships. And it's a constant piece of doubt, and what it does to our psychology is so detrimental, and something that I hope many people learn. You can avoid that experience, not entirely, not in totality, but you can certainly affect the outcome differently.
And understanding that potential is part of the process is kind of coming to a degree of acceptance that I have this. I'm not going to be the person that I maybe envisioned exactly in the form that I envisioned it.
Yeah.
And my goal here is to find a way to live as fully and happily despite having endo as I can.
Yeah.
There are similarities across other health conditions. Of course, you know, the mental health journey that people face is very similar. It's not pain per se, but it's a different chronic issue. There's other inflammatory diseases like Crohn's, colitis. People have to figure out how to live despite these. We see a lot of the similarities in people who are cancer survivors, the psychology of that disease changing their lives for the worse, and how, what if it comes back? There's a lot of psychology in health that needs to be front and center. Without it, we are so limited.
Yeah. And again, as you stated earlier, accessibility. I mean, we have this system that's scared of including psychology in coverage because they see it as this like abuse of, well, people will just, you know, utilize this and my question is still to those people, how do we not yet understand the impact on the ability to work, on the healthcare system, on you name it, every facet that's being affected by not supporting people's minds in the same way that we support their bodies, or kind of support their bodies at in some instances. And it's such a challenge. And I mean, I applaud your team. And I, it's the education piece that I really love watching with you, is that you're constantly on your platform and sharing that information in a way that does give validation. And it's amazing how quickly validation changes somebody's experience. So I'm just going to sit here and praise you for the next, you know, it's not just that you're a great surgeon. That's not even it for me. The part that has always impressed me about your approach to this is I felt seen, and that changes the medical experience immensely. And especially for somebody like me, I was the most resistant person to ending up on your surgery table. Like, I did not want that to be my journey. I was fearful of surgery. I was, the anxiety of that alone, probably, I was grateful your wait list was what it was eventually, because it was just like, okay, we've exhausted all of these things and now we've come to a place where surgery is the next step. And thank God you can't get me in tomorrow, because now I'm going to have to go on this journey of preparing to be okay to go into surgery. And people don't understand the level of complexity with it, because everybody's like, oh, you're finally going to be fixed. You're finally going to be better. You're finally going to have this done. And I'm going into it thinking, God, I hope this works. Like, God, I hope this makes a difference.
Your mentality towards surgery, I think, is the optimal mentality. We should really not aim for it. As a surgeon, I really, truly hope I never have to have surgery in my life. It's not something that we should aspire to. Yeah. And it's not, again, the panacea. So if you go into surgery thinking, I will be better, I will be great, I will be pain-free, the only real truth is you will be disappointed. Because it's so unlikely for that to be the case. And now, don't get me wrong, there are a few people who come back and they're like, my symptoms are all gone, all gone. I'm like, not what I was advertising here.
Yeah, but I'll take it.
Right? Like, this is a good thing. But that's the minority, and actually very small minority, who are so astronomically better post-op that they don't want to do physio. They don't want to do any psychology. Now, you know, depends how many years go by before.
I was going to say, until.
Exactly. Until they rear their head again and you're like, oh, you know, the surgical effect and the psychology of having surgery, because you know what? Surgery also makes people feel seen.
Yeah.
I really believe that surgery has an effect through multiple mechanisms. Of course, what we actually do by taking out things, but it is the most seen a person can feel, because that surgeon decided your problem is big enough that I need to cut into you. Yeah. And that, for a lot of people, is validating to the next level. So there's a therapeutic effect to that decision. And in the clinic, sometimes when we consent people for surgery, you see them like it's like they settle into their chair. All of a sudden, there's an anxiety, there's a strain that has just dissipated, like flown out of their body in that moment. And that's not even the surgery. That's just the, I will do surgery on you because I believe you that much.
Yeah.
So
I believe it. Like, I'm so intrigued by it all. It's so affirming, and I get it. That wasn't my experience. Mine was like sheer terror. You said it, and it was like everybody in my life was like, she's going to find a way to get out of this. she does not want to have to do surgery and at the time, had it not disrupted my life to the level it had, I probably would have still chose to just deal with the pain because the fear of it. And I will say this to anybody who is fearing surgery, and this is a complete segue and not related, and this is not like a promo for surgery at all, but I will say that going through the experience was not at all as bad as I anticipated with my anxiety. And I felt very cared for at every step. And I was so grateful for the people that were involved in the process, not just yourself, but your team is phenomenal. And I felt as safe as I could have felt in that moment. I felt it. So I am very appreciative of that from somebody who's like top phobias in life is definitely, it was on your table. That was not a happy place for me, but it was as good of an experience as it could have been. So thank you for that and to your team.
Yeah, I have to thank my team massively because I cannot do everything I do without the team.
For sure.
From Jen to Mandy to all of our fellows to our OR team, anesthesia, nursing. Our team is amazing and we really strive to do our best. I know sometimes we don't always meet people's expectations. We try, we really do. Mm-hmm. And so it's a team effort. And without them, I would be nothing. I would be unable to do my job, actually, because I cannot operate alone.
Yeah.
And I would not be able to provide the really well-balanced approach to patient care. That
And it's huge, and it makes a world of difference. And to every healthcare provider out there, I hope you're taking notes because it's true, right? From the people that you speak to when you're trying to book your appointment and the genuine care that I was given from that step right through till, you know, the anesthesiologist knowing my fear of anesthesia and stepping through that with me with kid gloves on was so appreciated. And just, it makes such a difference to feel like you're as safe as you can be. What is your advice to people? So you just alluded to that. And I hope I'm wrong. I hope that that minority that wakes up pain-free and lives the rest of their lives pain-free. I hope that's their reality. I don't wish any other experience for anybody. That would be lovely. But what's your advice to people? And what do you think people could do to potentially avoid that, a couple of years pass and all of a sudden that pain starts to creep back in and the level of disappointment and the level of, is this something that you believe proactively maybe people should be engaging in the therapies that are involved, even if you're feeling great, in hopes of prolonging that feeling?
Yes. And it comes back to the conversation we just had around the adolescents. You know, before things get bad, before there's daily pain and every system in the pelvis is dysfunctional, let's start to integrate the approach to knowledge of this space. Mm-hmm. So the psychology of it, the physio of it, how the GI system's inflammation effects can be also exacerbating of people's symptoms. So bringing in that multidisciplinary approach is really key early in life, but also even if you're doing well in the context of an endosurgery, being cognizant that these other spaces are going to be playing a big role in your ultimate outcome and probably also have impacts on future outcomes as well. Because we know every woman, every person with ovaries will become menopausal. And that's a really also challenging time. And so it's challenging from all of those domains. And we want to start to build in prophylactically strategies that you can use as you transition various life stages. Mm-hmm. But we can also work on trying to prevent recurrence of endometriosis through medical avenues as well. And there's evidence here. It's not the greatest evidence, but it's there nonetheless that does tell us endometriosis probably has a lower chance of recurring if we achieve menstrual suppression in people who have maintained their uterus after an endometriosis surgery. Mm-hmm. I don't make people do this. I'm very much not the type that makes people do anything. Yeah. I tell people what they can do and then they decide. But there is a bit of a reality that probably hormonal medications that achieve a state of no period, amenorrhea, have a lower chance of having recurrent endometriosis mm-hmm. in their future. Mm-hmm. So there's also that medical proactivity that can help with the future.
Yeah. And I would also suggest from a patient experience to the people who are hesitant to taking the hormonal therapies, the psychology aspect of that, again, is huge for support. Because I know for me personally, my experience with trying to suppress my period resulted in other issues that were deemed something I had to then deal with. I became very cystic in my breasts. So it became an issue that was creating a new issue. So that was something that I had to consider. It was never just about, I don't want to be on the pill, so I'm going to stop taking the pill. But I see a lot of that conversation. I see a lot of, I don't want to just be put on hormones, and I don't just want to, and I strongly encourage people to seek support, because ultimately when you are dealing with hormones, you are dealing with the very things that affect our moods in a way that don't necessarily make us capable of supporting our greatest behaviors or fighting for ourselves in the way that give us the best chance to show up. So I think that's a piece worth considering and worth making sure that we're aware of. And again, this multimodality approach is just so important.
Yeah. When we talk to patients about medications, in particular hormone medication, there is a very broad resistance. Mm-hmm. And I get it. You know, you don't want to modify what's happening naturally in your body.
Yeah.
And it does have side effects. However, and this comes back to the concept of acceptance, you do have to accept you have a hormonally sensitive disease.
Yeah.
And we can modify the hormones in a way that hopefully make that disease less active, less symptomatic.
Yeah.
And so you have to balance the reason you're doing it, which is the benefit, with the potential side effects. And I say to people, if the benefits outweigh the side effects, great. If they don't, and you're getting worse symptoms, worse issues on it, then one, it's not the right medication for you, or two, maybe we're just not going to use medications in you.
Yeah.
Although that second statement doesn't usually exist as truth, because there's often something we can find to help people.
Yeah.
And you're not taking it recreationally. You're not taking this because you want to, because although some people want contraception, and then those people actually tend to be much more willing to be on the hormonal medications.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're taking it for a reason, and quite a good reason. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of open our mind to that a little bit.
And validate that as well.
Yeah, for sure. We're not doing it in isolation. We're not just writing a prescription and saying, see you later. Mm-hmm. We're doing this medication in the context of a multimodal approach as well.
Yeah.
So the effectiveness, hopefully all in with the multiple therapies, is going to be greater. Maybe you can manage some of the side effects through some of these other multimodal solutions as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I do tell people to keep an open mind when they come.
Yeah.
When they see me, they've often seen many people before, tried many things before.
Yeah.
We got to kind of start from scratch and revisit some of the things that we've already closed the door on.
Yeah.
Not just medications, but some people say, I've already done physio. Well,
yeah.
It's not something you kind of do and then don't do. It's kind of like exercise and eating healthy.
Yeah.
You have to maintain the health of the muscles. So same psychology, you know, you don't just do it once and then never again.
Yeah.
These are maintenance related issues.
Yeah. And I feel for the people in terms of accessibility where that's not an option. And that's another struggle and another conversation to be had in terms of supporting women's health in our healthcare system.
Yeah. We need this to be universally available. It's not now. And people who can access these allied healthcare professionals often have to have their own extended health benefit programs through their employer or that they purchase. This is not sustainable. And there are also caps and limitations. So through the SOGC, through CanSage, through our collaborations across Ontario with other endometriosis experts, we are constantly advocating for better integration of allied healthcare professionals into our health systems in a way that is universally accessible.
Yeah.
Wait times will always be a thing in Canada, because if there is a universally accessible service, lots of people will want it and need it, and people will have to wait. And that's unfortunately just going to be the reality, I think.
Yeah.
But right now, the avenue to access this is through the out of pocket or extended health benefits scheme. And that's unfortunate, but this is also the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, a whole other conversation, and something I just wanted to say that I absolutely have empathy for those who are struggling with that part of this discussion, because it's not fair. This is something that, you know, best care should be the practice across the board, and accessibility to best care should be a given. Mm-hmm. I could talk to you for hours. I just want to thank you for your time. I appreciate you so much and the work you're doing in this space. I'm excited to keep involved in your programs and the approach here, and keep learning on this journey. And to anybody out there who is dealing with chronic pain, who is dealing with endometriosis, you are not alone with this, and please seek supports, because pain has the ability to really isolate you. And it's something that I really hope that you're finding ways to not go through this alone. But Dr. Leonardi, thank you so much for the work you do and for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you, Kendra. And thanks to all the listeners out there. There is help available. Finding it sometimes is a challenge, but it's there. And if you are struggling with endometriosis, the Endometriosis Network Canada is progressively providing more and more resources. There's a page of endometriosis surgeons as well now. So please don't hesitate to use the available resources and find people who are more knowledgeable who can help.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks for hanging out with us on another episode of Speakeasy, where we believe conversations are meant to be had out loud. Share this episode to help others find our show, and don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also join me at kfisher30 on Instagram as I travel across Canada and the US tackling the current mental health crisis with colleges and universities.